Chapter 3. Pandemics. Throughout history, philosophers believed that comets were harbingers of doom, disease, and death, infecting men with a bloodlust to war, contaminating crops, and dispersing disease and plague. The Chinese textbook Mwangdui Silk details 29 types of comets, dating back to 1500 BC, and the disasters that followed each one. "Comets are vile stars," wrote a Chinese official in 648 AD. "Every time they appear in the south, they wipe out the old and establish the new. Fish grow sick, crops fail. Emperors and common people die, and men go to war. The people hate life and don't want to speak of it." In medieval Europe and even in colonial America, observers associated the appearance of comets with the onset of disease. In the summer of 536 AD, a mysterious and dramatic cloud of dust appeared over the Mediterranean and for 18 months darkened the sky as far east as China. According to the Byzantine historian Procopius, during this year a most dread portent took place. "For the sun gave forth its light without brightness. And it seemed exceedingly like the sun in eclipse, for the beams it shed were not clear." Analysis of Greenland ice deposited between 533 and 540 AD shows high levels of tin, nickel, and iron oxides, suggesting that a comet or fragment of a comet may have hit the Earth at that time. The impact likely triggered volcanic eruptions, which spewed more dust into the atmosphere. With the darkened sky, temperatures dropped, crops failed, and famine descended on many parts of the world. Shortly afterward, in 541 AD, a mysterious illness began to appear on the outskirts of the Byzantine Empire. Victims suffered from delusions, nightmares, and fevers. They had lymph node swellings in the groin, armpits, and behind their ears. The plague, named after the reigning emperor Justinian, arrived in Constantinople, the capital, in 542. Procopius noted that bodies were left stacked in the open due to a lack of space for proper burial. He estimated that in the city at its peak, the plague was killing 10,000 people per day. The current explanation for the correlation of comets and disease is that of panspermia. We now know that outer space is populated by clouds of microorganisms, and the theory holds that comets are watery bodies, dirty snowballs, that rain new microscopic forms on the Earth, to which humans and animals have no immunity. However, recent evidence indicates little if any water on comets. Rather, they are asteroids that have an elliptical orbit and become charged electrically as they approach the Sun, an exchange that creates the comet's bright coma and tail. Their surfaces exhibit the kind of features that happen with intense electrical arcing, like craters and cliffs. Bright or shiny spots on otherwise barren rocky surfaces indicate areas that are electrically charged. Comets contain mineral alloys requiring temperatures in the thousands of degrees, and they have sufficient energy to emit extreme UV light and even powerful X-rays. Moreover, as comets approach the Sun, they can provoke high-energy discharges and flare-ups of solar plasma, which reach out to the comet. Thus, comets can create electrical disturbances in the atmosphere even more powerful than those created by man-made electrification, and this radiation includes demonstrably dangerous ionizing radiation. No wonder the ancients were afraid of comets. The conventional view holds that the plague of Justinian was a case of bubonic plague. Researchers analyzed the remains from graves of the period and detected DNA from the Yersinia pestis. Mainstream thinking has concluded that rats and other rodents carry Yersinia pestis and pass it along to fleas. When rats die, the blood-sucking fleas leave them to prey on other rats, dogs, and humans. The bacteria then enter humans via flea bites. Researchers believe that during the time of Justinian, rats on merchant ships carried the microorganism to the other Mediterranean ports. The classic sign of bubonic plague are buboes, badly swollen lymph nodes. These often appear in the groin because, according to conventional thinking, most flea bites occur on the legs. Those infected will first experience fevers, chills, and muscle pains before developing septicemia or pneumonia. The plague reappeared at periodic intervals over the next 300 years, with the last recorded occurrence in 750 AD, possibly explained by still-orbiting cometary debris. It eventually claimed 25% of inhabitants in the Mediterranean region. "For the sun gave forth its light without brightness and it seemed exceedingly like the sun in eclipse, for the beams it shed were not clear." According to historian Thomas Short, in France was seen the terrible comet called Negra. In December appeared over Avignon a pillar of fire. There were many great earthquakes, tempests, thunders and lightnings, and thousands of people were swallowed up. The courses of rivers were stopped. Some chasms of the earth sent forth blood. Terrible showers of hail, each stone weighing 1 pound to 8. Abortions in all countries. In Germany it rained blood. In France blood gushed out of graves of the dead, and stained the rivers crimson. Comets, meteors, fire beams, coruscations in the air, mock suns, the heavens on fire. According to textbooks, the same bubonic plague organism of Justinian's time caused the Black Death in Europe, 1347-1350. However, some investigators have pointed out flaws in this theory. Although researchers found evidence of Yersinia pestis in dental pulp from a mass grave of the period in France, other teams of scientists were unable to find evidence of the pathogen in 5 other grave sites of the period from other parts of Europe. Sociologist Susan Scott and biologist Christopher J. Duncan claim that a hemorrhagic fever, similar to the Ebola virus, caused the Black Death. Others blame anthrax or some now extinct disease. They note that medieval accounts don't square with modern descriptions of the illness. Witnesses described a disease that spread at great speed with very high mortality, unlike the plague, which moves slowly and had a death rate of about 60%. Accounts describe buboes covering the entire body rather than limited to the groin area as in the case of plague. Symptom descriptions mention awful odors, splotches resembling bruises, delirium, and stupor, none of which happen with modern-day bubonic plague. Some critics have embraced the theory that a virus caused the disease, but this premise hardly provides a better explanation than does bacteria to explain the disease's rapid spread and high mortality. Then there is the rat problem. No written documents from that time describe vast legions of dead rats required to explain the plague. The Black Death killed over half of Iceland's population, but rats didn't reach Iceland until the 19th century. And the Black Death continued to kill people during the winter months in northern Europe despite the fact that the plague organism requires relatively warm temperatures. In New Light on the Black Death, The Cosmic Connection, Professor Mike Bailey argues that a comet caused the pandemic. He points out that witnesses of the period describe a significant earthquake on January 25, 1348, with other earthquakes to follow. There have been masses of dead fish, animals, and other things along the seashore and in many places covered in dust, wrote a contemporary observer. And all these things seem to have come from the great corruption of the air and earth. Other documents describe tidal waves, rains of fire, foul odors, strange colors in the sky, mists and even dragons, in addition to earthquakes. Bailey believes that fragments from Comet Negra, which passed by Earth in 1347, caused the atmospheric phenomena. Some fragments descended and injected huge amounts of dust into the atmosphere. Tree ring analysis indicates that as the material descended from space, it spewed large amounts of chemicals based on carbon and nitrogen into the stratosphere. According to Bailey, illness and death resulted from poisoned water and air as the comet flew overhead. But the symptoms, especially bruise-like blotches on the skin and high fatality rate, indicate radiation poisoning, probably rendered even more deadly by dust and ammonia-like compounds in the atmosphere. Imagine a large comet passing near the Earth, crackling with intense electrical arcing, pelting the Earth with X-rays and casting off fragments that fall to the Earth and spew up toxic clouds of dust, followed immediately by horrible death, sometimes wiping out whole towns. This is not the kind of catastrophe that we can blame on microbes. Perhaps our solar system is calming down, mankind has not seen such violent phenomena for centuries. But smaller electrical disturbances, ones that can't be seen, are still likely to promote outbreaks, albeit less disastrous. And if radiation poisoning, whether ionizing or non-ionizing, provokes disease, there are obvious cofactors. Poisons in air, water, and food, toxins from insect bites, deadly fungi on grains, exposure to filth, malnutrition, and starvation, as well as fear and despair, we don't need to resort to the notion of contagion to explain outbreaks of disease. Let us consider insect-borne diseases. Many, if not most, biting or stinging insects release toxins, often complex chemicals, that can target the nervous system. Wasps, bees, flies, beetles, mosquitoes, ticks, bedbugs, lice, and ants all produce poisonous substances. Early studies suggest that insect saliva has chemicals with vasodilatory, anticoagulant, and immunosuppressive properties, although in recent times there has been little interest in or research money for the study of insect saliva. In addition to overt poisons, insect saliva may contain parasite eggs. Tapeworms can be transmitted by fleas, and mosquito bites contain the eggs of Plasmodium, a parasite said to cause malaria. Mosquitoes also carry fly larvae, which can enter the body through bites, causing meiosis, a parasitic infestation of the body by fly larvae, maggots, which grow inside the host. Some mosquito species can carry filariasis, a parasite that causes a disfiguring condition called elephantiasis. These diseases are infectious, in the sense that people acquire them from something outside the body, such as an insect, but only in the most bizarre of circumstances can they be transferred from one human being to another. Actually, scientists have yet to solve the mystery of malaria, a disease that kills over 1,000 people per day. The conventional view is that mosquitoes in tropical and subtropical regions transfer parasites to human blood through their bites, and this parasite then destroys red blood cells and causes intermittent fever. But the type of mosquito said to cause malaria inhabits every continent except Antarctica, including Europe and North America, where malaria is no longer a problem. From the 15th century until recent times, many people in England suffered from malaria under the name of marsh fever, or ague, always associated with living in swampy marshes. In fact, what is common to areas known for malaria, both today and in the past, is human habitation in swamps and wetlands, and not just warm wetlands, which are conducive to mosquitoes, but also wetlands in cooler areas such as England. Wetlands produce swamp gases, a mixture of hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, and especially methane. Methane poisoning causes fever, headaches, muscle weakness, nausea, vomiting, and feelings of asphyxiation, remarkably similar to the symptoms of malaria: fever, muscle weakness, nausea, vomiting, and chest and abdominal pain. Like malaria, methane poisoning can result in the destruction of red blood cells. In areas of the world where people still live in swampy areas, intermittent exposure to swamp gases, which are undoubtedly stronger during warm weather or flooding seasons, seems a better explanation than mosquitoes for this stubborn disease. The conventional view holds that viral diseases, such as yellow fever, dengue fever, Zika fever, and chikungunya are transmitted by mosquitoes carrying viruses that attach to and enter susceptible cells. According to textbooks, once these viruses enter the body and begin to replicate inside the cells, they are contagious and are spread from person to person through airborne droplets, sexual contact, eating food and drinking water contaminated with the virus, and even touching surfaces and bodily fluids contaminated with the virus. But we don't need the concepts of viruses and contagion to explain these diseases. Environments infested with fleas, mosquitoes, lice, and other insects carrying toxins or parasites will result in many individuals, especially individuals with suboptimal nutrition, manifesting similar symptoms, an outbreak that requires no premise of person-to-person contact, only many people subject to the same stressors. For example, the outbreak of Zika virus, blamed for a rash of babies born with tragically small heads, followed a campaign of DPT vaccinations given to poor pregnant women in Brazil. Toxins are powerful stressors. Sewage fumes contain a mixture of toxic gaseous compounds, such as hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, methane, and ammonia. High concentrations of methane and carbon dioxide displace oxygen. In conditions of low oxygen, beneficial fermentative bacteria begin producing toxins instead of helpful compounds. Industrial chemicals in sewage can add to the adverse effects, especially if these toxins make their way into drinking water. In times past, these toxins included mercury, arsenic, and lead. Lead used for roofing, tanks, gutters, pipes, cables, and winemaking, and even added to recipes in Roman times, poisoned directly, through drinking water, or through the skin. Renaissance noblewomen wore makeup containing white lead ore, vinegar, arsenic, hydroxide, and carbonate, applied to the face over egg whites or a mercury foundation. Arsenic face powder was the crowning touch. The price for the flawless complexion was paralysis, madness, and death. Leather tanning contributed greatly to water pollution. Lime, tannin, animal dung, urine, alum, and arsenic were used in the process. The Industrial Revolution added toxic chromium solution to the mix. production of red paint and dyes, metal extraction, and caustic soda production released mercury. Both mercury and arsenic were popular ingredients in medicines, and they no doubt carried off as many people as the diseases themselves. The severe vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration, and muscle cramping of cholera is blamed on the bacterium Vibrio cholerae, either from sewage-tainted water or shellfish like oysters living in sewage-tainted water. Actually, the killer is a toxin, called cholera toxin, CT, which the bacteria produce under low oxygen conditions. Although CT can be deadly, it also has anti-inflammatory properties and has shown promise as an immunotherapeutic drug. Cholera affects up to 5 million people, mostly in third world countries, and causes over 100,000 deaths per year. Treatment includes oral rehydration therapy and zinc supplementation. Children are highly susceptible to CT, as are those who are malnourished or have lowered immunity. One strange observation is the fact that type O blood types are more likely to contract cholera. Even today, with the medical world's fixation on person-to-person transmission of disease and prevention through vaccination, health authorities agree that the solution to cholera is better sanitation. Cholera is rarely spread directly from person to person, but only through filthy drinking water. An outbreak of cholera occurred in Soho, London, in 1854. According to Judith Summers in Broad Street Pumpout Reek, by the middle of the 19th century, Soho had become an insanitary place of cowsheds, animal droppings, slaughterhouses, grease-boiling dens and primitive, decaying sewers. And underneath the floorboards of the overcrowded cellars lurked something even worse, a fetid sea of cesspits as old as the houses, and many of which had never been drained. It was only a matter of time before this hidden festering time bomb exploded. The previous year, over 10,000 people died of cholera in England. The outbreak in Soho appeared suddenly. Few families, rich or poor, were spared the loss of at least one member. Within a week, three-quarters of the residents had fled from their homes, leaving their shops shuttered, their houses locked and the streets deserted. Only those who could not afford to leave remained there. It was like the Great Plague all over again. Dr. John Snow lived in the center of the outbreak and traced the source to a pump on the corner of Broad and Cambridge Streets, at the epicenter of the epidemic. "I found," he wrote afterward, "that nearly all the deaths had taken place within a short distance of the pump. In fact, in houses much nearer another pump, only 10 deaths occurred, and of those, 5 victims had drunk the water from the Broad Street pump. Workers in a local brewery did not get sick, they drank beer provided as a perk of employment." Dr. Snow blamed the outbreak not on toxins but on white, flocculent particles, which he observed under a microscope. 3 decades later, Robert Koch tried injecting a culture of these white flocculent particles into animals, without succeeding in getting them sick, so cholera failed his second postulate. Cholera also failed his first postulate, as V. Rio cholerae appeared in both sick and healthy people. Even so, he remained convinced that this bacillus was the cause of cholera. Old ideas are difficult to dislodge even in the face of conflicting evidence. It bears emphasis that all cities up to the 19th century were fetid seas of horse droppings, stinking manure piles, primitive water sanitation, toxic chemicals, crowded living conditions, loose pigs, and even raw sewage dumped from houses. Swill from inner city breweries went to cows in inner city confinement dairies, producing poisoned milk in conditions of unimaginable filth. The death rate among children born in these conditions was 50%. Officials blamed the death rate on the milk, which became the justification for pasteurization laws instituted 100 years later. By then, the problem had resolved itself with improved water and sewer systems, better living conditions, the advent of refrigeration, laws prohibiting inner-city breweries and dairies, and, most important, replacement of the horse with the car. Automobiles and buses brought in a different kind of pollution, but new technologies at least ensured that the water was finally clean. Much infectious disease cleared up, thanks not to doctors but rather to inventors and civil engineers. One invention that made life safer was the washing machine, making it easier to keep clothes and bedding clean, especially as more and more dwellings had hot running water. Another invention was the vacuum cleaner, which helped keep living quarters free of bugs. Window screens also helped. At the turn of the 20th century, health officials considered smallpox to be highly infectious, but one physician disagreed. Dr. Charles A.R. Campbell of San Antonio, Texas, believed that smallpox was transmitted by the bites of bedbugs. The modern official view holds that smallpox resulted from contact with a contagious virus. Transmission occurred through inhalation of airborne variola virus, usually droplets expressed from the oral, nasal, or pharyngeal mucosa of an infected person. It was transmitted from one person to another primarily through prolonged face-to-face contact with an infected person, usually within a distance of 1.8 meters 6 feet, but could also be spread through direct contact with infected bodily fluids or contaminated objects, fomites, such as bedding or clothing. The infected person was contagious until the last smallpox scab fell off. Smallpox was not known to be transmitted by insects or animals. Note that this description is written in the past tense. The official view is that smallpox has been conquered by vaccination, not by something as simple as getting rid of bedbugs. Dr. Campbell ran a pest house for smallpox patients in San Antonio, where he tried hard to infect himself and others by fomites and direct face-to-face contact with infected persons. As even the air itself, without contact, is considered sufficient to convey this disease, and touching the clothes of a smallpox patient considered equivalent to contract it, I exposed myself with the same impunity as my pest house keeper. After numerous exposures, made in the ordinary manner, by going from house to house where the disease was, I have never conveyed this disease to my family, or to any of my patients or friends, although I did not disinfect myself or my clothes, nor take any precautions whatever, except to be sure that no bedbugs got about my clothing. Another one of my experiments was thoroughly to beat a rug in a room, only 8 or 10 feet square, from which had just been removed a smallpox patient. I beat this rug in the room until the air was stifling, and remained therein for 30 minutes. This represented the respiratory as well as the digestive systems as accepted avenues of infection. After inhaling the dust from that rug, I examined my sputum microscopically the following morning and found cotton and woolen fibers, pollen and comminuted manure, and also bacteria of many kinds. Although Dr. Campbell subsequently mingled with family, patients, and friends, none contracted smallpox. He repeated these experiments with others, failing to infect, even when in contact with patients covered in sores, but he always found bedbugs in the houses of those who contracted the disease. The British and American colonists used smallpox as a weapon against the Native Americans. They did it by giving them blankets, thus spreading the bedbug to the New World. Campbell treated smallpox by administering sources of vitamin C. The most important observation on the medical aspect of this disease is the cachexia, bad condition, with which it is associated, and which is actually the soil requisite for its different degrees of virulence. I refer to the scorbutic cachexia. Among the lower classes of people, this particular acquitted constitutional perversion of nutrition is most prevalent, primarily on account of their poverty, but also because of the fact that they care little or nothing for fruits or vegetables. That it is more prevalent in winter when the anti-scorbutics are scarce and high-priced, and finally, that the removal of this perversion of nutrition will so mitigate the virulence of this malady as positively to prevent the pitting or pocking of smallpox. A failure of the fruit crop in any particularly large area is always followed the succeeding winter by the presence of smallpox. Dr. Campbell also applied himself to the elimination of mosquitoes by constructing huge bat houses. He was a great admirer of this strange winged creature and knew how to harness its help in the elimination of annoying insects, assumed to cause malaria. Campbell was an inventive and colorful character, full of good ideas, yet hardly mentioned in medical journals or in histories of disease. Where's the glamour of a solution that involves clean beds and fresh fruit compared with the heroics of vaccination? Smallpox vaccinations so toxic that health officials no longer recommend them. Unlike the forgotten Dr. Campbell, Dr. Robert Koch is immortalized as the father of microbiology and the germ theory. Unable to prove that a microorganism caused cholera, and in the case of rabies, knowing that Pasteur was unable to even find an organism, Dr. Koch turned his attention to tuberculosis, TB. According to a historical article published in World of Microbiology and Immunology, in 6 months, Koch succeeded in isolating a bacillus from tissues of humans and animals infected with tuberculosis. In 1882, he published a paper declaring that this bacillus met his four conditions, that is, it was isolated from diseased animals, it was grown in a pure culture, it was transferred to a healthy animal who then developed the disease, and it was isolated from the animal infected by the cultured organism. When he presented his findings before the Physiological Society in Berlin on March 24, he held the audience spellbound, so logical and thorough was his delivery of this important finding. This day has come to be known as the day modern bacteriology was born. In 1905, Dr. Koch received the Nobel Prize for proving that TB was an infectious disease. Except he didn't. In fact, he could find an organism in infected tissue only by using special staining methods after the tissue was heated and dehydrated with alcohol. The stain was a toxic dye, methylene blue, and the solution he used contained another toxin, potassium hydroxide, lye. When he injected the organism stained with these poisons into animals, they got sick. But what caused the illness, the bacillus or the poisons? And TB does not even satisfy Koch's first postulate. Only one person in 10 who tests positive for TB actually develops the disease. Those who don't are said to have latent TB. Even into the 1930s and 1940s, some scientists remained skeptical of the germ theory for TB. Many still believed that the cause was genetic. An investigator who disputed both theories was the dentist Weston A. Price, author of the groundbreaking book Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. During the 1930s and 1940s, he traveled around the globe to study the health of so-called primitive peoples, living on ancestral diets. As a dentist, he naturally observed dental and facial formation and the presence or absence of tooth decay. He found 14 groups in regions as diverse as the Swiss Alps, the Outer Hebrides, Alaska, South America, Australia, and the South Seas, in which every member of the tribe or village exhibited wide facial structure, naturally straight teeth, and freedom from tooth decay. He also noted the absence of disease in these well-nourished groups. As soon as the displacing foods of modern commerce made inroads into a population, they became vulnerable to both chronic and infectious disease, especially TB. The children born to those who adopted the Western diet of sanitary, processed food, sugar, white flour, canned foods, and vegetable oils, were born with more narrow faces, crowded and crooked teeth, pinched nasal passages, narrow configuration of the birth canal, and less robust body formation. Price rejected the notion that TB was inherited or caused by a microorganism, transmittable by droplets released into the air in the coughs and sneezes of the infected. He surmised that the root cause was a malformation of the lungs, similar to the narrowing of the facial structure and dental deformities in those born to parents eating processed foods. In a visit to a pediatric TB ward in Hawaii, he noted that every patient had dental deformities. These dental deformities did not cause TB, of course, but Dr. Price believed that the same conditions that prevented the optimal formation of the facial bones also prevented optimal formation of the lungs. It was the dead and dying tissue in the lungs that attracted bacteria, nature's cleanup crew, and not the microorganism that caused the disease. He noted that Swiss villagers living off their native diets of raw dairy products, sourdough rye bread, and some meat and organ meats had no TB, and this was a time when TB was the number one killer in Switzerland and elsewhere. Likewise, inhabitants of Lewis Island in the Outer Hebrides were free of TB. Their nutrient-dense diet consisted of seafood, including fish livers and fish liver oil, along with oat porridge and oat cakes. They lived in thatched houses that had no chimneys, living in close quarters with smoky, polluted air night and day. Still, they had no TB. When modern foods made their appearance, the situation changed, and TB took hold. Health workers blamed the smoky air of their cottages, not a microorganism, and made them install chimneys, but to no avail. Only Weston A. Price was curious about the fact that the well-nourished islanders were immune, even when living in smoke-filled houses. Similarly, he observed that African tribesmen living on traditional foods seemed immune to the diseases in Africa, even though they went barefoot, drank unsanitary water, and lived in areas that swarmed with mosquitoes. Europeans visiting Africa needed to cover themselves completely and sleep under protective netting to avoid disease. Once the continent of Africa became coca-colonized, these diseases proliferated among the Africans. During the time of Dr. Price's research, it was not the so-called infectious diseases of Africa that struck terror in American minds, it was polio. According to health officials, the cause was an infectious virus. This virus didn't just make people, especially young people, sick, it occasionally left them crippled. Pictures of grown men in iron lungs and children wearing leg braces seared the national consciousness. In the mid-1950s, physician Morton S. Biskind testified before Congress. Dr. Biskind's message was not what the legislators wanted to hear. Polio was the result of central nervous system (CNS) poison, not a virus, and the chief CNS poison of the day was a chemical called dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, commonly known as DDT. Used in World War II to control mosquitoes said to cause malaria and typhus among civilians and troops, its inventor, Paul Hermann Müller, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1948, for his discovery of the high efficiency of DDT as a contact poison against several arthropods. By October 1945, DDT was available for public sale in the United States. Government and industry promoted its use as an agricultural and household pesticide, really promoted it. Photographs from the era show housewives filling their houses with DDT fog, dairy farmers dusting cows in their cowsheds, even spraying it into the milk, crop dusters depositing DDT on fields and forests, and children on beaches enveloped in the pesticide. An attachment for your mower could distribute DDT over your lawn, and trucks spray DDT on city streets, children cheerfully playing in the spray. DDT largely replaced another CNS poison, lead arsenate, introduced in 1898 for use on crops and orchards. Before that, the preferred spray was plain arsenic. Biskind wrote, in 1945, against the advice of investigators who had studied the pharmacology of the compound and found it dangerous for all forms of life, DDT was released in the United States and other countries for general use by the public as an insecticide. It was even known by 1945 that DDT is stored in the body fat of mammals and appears in the milk. With this foreknowledge, the series of catastrophic events that followed the most intensive campaign of mass poisoning in known human history should not have surprised the experts. Yet, far from admitting a causal relationship so obvious that in any other field of biology it would be instantly accepted, virtually the entire apparatus of communication, lay and scientific alike, has been devoted to denying, concealing, suppressing, distorting and attempts to convert into its opposite, the overwhelming evidence. Libel, slander and economic boycott have not been overlooked in this campaign. Early in 1949, as a result of studies during the previous year, the author published reports implicating DDT preparations in the syndrome widely attributed to a virus X in man, in X disease in cattle and in often fatal syndromes in dogs and cats. The relationship was promptly denied by government officials, who provided no evidence to contest the author's observations but relied solely on the prestige of government authority and sheer numbers of experts to bolster their position. X disease, studied by the author following known exposure to DDT and related compounds and over again in the same patients, each time following known exposure. We have described the syndrome as follows: in acute exacerbations, mild clonic convulsions involving mainly the legs, have been observed. Several young children exposed to DDT developed a limp lasting from 2 or 3 days to a week or more. Particularly relevant to recent aspects of this problem are neglected studies by Lilly and his collaborators of the National Institutes of Health, published in 1944 and 1947 respectively, which showed that DDT may produce degeneration of the anterior horn cells of the spinal cord in animals. These changes do not occur regularly in exposed animals any more than they do in human beings, but they do appear often enough to be significant. When the population is exposed to a chemical agent known to produce in animals lesions in the spinal cord resembling those in human polio, and thereafter the latter disease increases sharply in incidence and maintains its epidemic character year after year, is it unreasonable to suspect an etiologic relationship? Investigator Jim West unearthed Biskind's writings and testimony, along with other reports about the effects of poisons on the CNS, dating from the mid-19th century. West compiled the following graphs, noting the correlation of pesticide use and polio incidence in the United States. As use of DDT in the United States declined, so did the incidence of polio. Vaccination programs were introduced at the same time and take credit for the decline. West says, a clear, direct, one-to-one relationship between pesticides and polio over a period of 30 years, with pesticides preceding polio incidents in the context of the central nervous system. Related physiology leaves little room for complicated virus arguments, even as a cofactor, unless there exists a rigorous proof for virus causation. Polio shows no movement independent from pesticide movement, as one would expect if it were caused by a virus. Both the medical and popular imaginations are haunted by the image of a virus that invades or infects and begins replicating to the point of producing disease. In the laboratory, however, poliovirus does not easily behave in such a predatory manner. Laboratory attempts to demonstrate causation are performed under conditions which are extremely artificial and aberrant. West notes that in 1908-1909, German researchers Landsteiner and Popper in Germany claimed to have isolated polio virus and used it to cause polio in monkeys. Their method was to inject a pulverized puree of diseased brain tissue into the brains of two monkeys. One monkey died, and the other was sickened. Headlines trumpeted this proof of polio virus causation. The weakness of this method is obvious to everyone except certain viropathologists, said West. Never has polio contagion passed muster with Rivers' postulates. The injection of puree of diseased brain tissue into the brains of dogs was the method preferred by Louis Pasteur to establish microbial causation of rabies, and indeed, injecting smooshed brains into their heads often made them foam at the mouth and die. Many of Pasteur's contemporaries disagreed strongly that rabies, also called hydrophobia, was a contagious disease and pointed out that the vaccine often caused great harm to animals and people. Even Pasteur's contemporary germ theorist Robert Koch discouraged the use of the rabies vaccine. Vets of the era believed that dogs became rabid when they were starved and mistreated. Dr. Matthew Woods of Philadelphia noted that, at the Philadelphia Dog Pound, where on average more than 6,000 vagrant dogs are taken annually, and where the catcher and keepers are frequently bitten while handling them, not one case of hydrophobia, rabies, has occurred during its entire history of 25 years, in which time 150,000 dogs have been handled. During the 1960s, researchers succeeded in inducing symptoms of rabies in experimental animals by putting them in bat caverns where they could breathe the toxic stultifying vapors of bat guano, later claiming to have isolated an airborne rabies virus. To test whether this so-called virus caused rabies, one researcher inoculated mice intracerebrally. 50% died within 48 hours, but none developed rabies. As for polio, even with worldwide vaccination programs, polio has not gone away, either in the United States or in third world countries. Today in the United States, it has received a new name, acute flaccid paralysis, AFP, displaying symptoms identical to polio, with over 200 cases recorded in 2018. Many parents have observed that the condition appears after a vaccination. CDC's pathetic advice: to prevent infections in general, persons should stay home if they are ill, wash their hands often with soap and water, avoid close contact, such as touching and shaking hands, with those who are ill, and clean and disinfect frequently touched surfaces. In some areas of the world, such as India and Africa, the incidence of acute flaccid paralysis has skyrocketed, which many blame on campaigns to administer experimental polio vaccines to children ages 0 to 5. Indian researchers described this strong correlation in a 2018 publication in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health and calculated that, countrywide from 2000 to 2017, there were an additional 491,000 paralyzed children in excess of the expected numbers. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys suggests that, far from credit for eliminating childhood paralysis going to vaccination campaigns, there is strong evidence pointing to the likelihood that experimental polio vaccination is related to the sharp rise in AFP. If the true cause of epidemics is exposure to electrical pollution or toxins from insects, industrial poisons, toxins produced by bacteria under conditions of filth, vaccinations, and drugs, with substandard nutrition as a cofactor, what about the outbreaks of disease in the Americas, in Africa, and in the South Seas, when these aboriginal peoples first met the European colonists? Didn't they begin to suffer from infectious disease as soon as they came in contact with infectious diseases carried to the New World on boats from the Old World, diseases to which they had no immunity? Actually, native peoples did not contract disease immediately on contact with the Europeans. For example, Fishermen and early explorers visited the northeastern waters along the Atlantic coast during the 15th and 16th centuries, yet we have no historical commentary on the existence of disease or epidemics among the Aboriginal peoples during that time. According to Raymond O. Baum-Sain, in his report, Historical and Scientific Perspectives on the Health of Canada's First Peoples, since the prime purpose of this early contact was to commercially exploit natural resources, any visible evidence of the physical weakness or sickness of the Indigenous inhabitants would surely have excited some keen interest. Instead, these early reports marveled at the Native Americans' good health and robust constitution. O. Baum-Sain notes that the first recorded outbreaks of disease in Native Americans living in the Ottawa Valleys occurred between 1734 and 1741. Samuel de Champlain had established the first European settlement at Quebec on the St. Lawrence River over 100 years earlier, in 1608, and it wasn't until the 1800s that smallpox, dysentery, typhus, yellow fever, tuberculosis, syphilis, and various other fevers became prevalent in the Aboriginal population. By the mid-18th century, Native American life had succumbed to serious disruptions. As a result of intensive trapping, the game populations had dwindled, seriously affecting the availability of food and skins to make clothing and footwear. During this period, sugar, white flour, coffee, tea, and alcohol arrived on trading ships, which the colonists traded with the Indians for furs. The same pattern prevailed on the West Coast, where the salmon fisheries became depleted by the mid-1800s. These Northwest peoples spoke of disease boats, or pestilence canoes, the Spanish and British seagoing vessels that arrived with increasing frequency. They brought smallpox, but also the foods that made them vulnerable to smallpox. An early 100-foot sailing cargo vessel could transport as much as 800,000 pounds of goods. Or maybe we should say, bads, including blankets for the Native Americans. Tribal peoples largely dependent upon the buffalo were not affected until the early 1870s, when the animals became depleted through exploitation and deliberate campaigns to kill off the herds upon which they depended. According to a Canadian government report, the transformation of Aboriginal people from the state of good health that had impressed travelers from Europe to one of ill health grew worse as sources of food and clothing from the land declined and traditional economies collapsed. It grew worse still as once mobile peoples were confined to small plots of land where resources and opportunities for natural sanitation were limited. It worsened yet again as long-standing norms, values, social systems and spiritual practices were undermined or outlawed. Regarding the Plymouth colony, the Pilgrims were not the first Europeans in the area. European fishermen had been sailing off the New England coast, with considerable Native American contact, for much of the 16th and 17th centuries, and trading for beaver skins commenced in the early 1600s, prior to the arrival of the Pilgrims in 1620. In 1605, the Frenchman Samuel de Champlain made an extensive and detailed map of the area and the surrounding lands, showing the Patuxet village, site of the future town of Plymouth, as a thriving settlement. In 1617-1618, just prior to the arrival of the Mayu flower, a mysterious epidemic wiped out up to 90% of the Indian population along the Massachusetts coast. History books blame the epidemic on smallpox, but a recent analysis has concluded that it may have been a disease called leptospirosis. Even today, leptospirosis kills almost 60,000 people per year. Leptospirosis is a blood infection similar to malaria, associated with various forms of spirochete bacteria. Other forms of spirochete parasites characterize syphilis, yaws, and Lyme disease. Humans encounter these spirochetes through animal urine or water and soil contaminated with animal urine coming into contact with the eyes, mouth, nose, or cuts. The disease is associated with poor sanitation. Both wild and domestic animals can transmit leptospirosis through their urine and other fluids. Rodents are the most common vector, and the beaver is a rodent. One important factor omitted from discussions about Native American diseases is the disruption of the salt trade. The first European explorers in the New World did not come to the East Coast but to Florida and the southeastern part of North America. During the 1540s, 80 years before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, the explorer Hernando de Soto led the first European expedition deep into the territory of the modern-day United States. They traversed Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and possibly Arkansas, and they saw the Mississippi River. Some anthropologists have insisted that the Native Americans did not consume salt, but De Soto received an abundance of good salt as a gift from the Native Americans, and he observed the production and trade of salt in the southeastern part of the country. In the lower Mississippi Valley, he met traveling Native American merchants selling salt. According to the De Soto records, lack of salt could lead to a most unfortunate death. Some of those whose constitutions must have demanded salt more than others died a most unusual death for lack of it. They were seized with a very slow fever, on the third or fourth day of which there was no one at 50 feet could endure the stench of their bodies, it being more offensive than that of the carcasses of dogs or cats. Thus they perished without remedy, for they were ignorant as to what their malady might be or what could be done for them, since they had neither physicians nor medicines. And it was believed that they could not have benefited from such had they possessed them, because from the moment they first felt the fever, their bodies were already in a state of decomposition. Indeed, from the chest down, their bellies and intestines were as green as grass. The most important sources of salt were the salt springs that dotted northwestern Louisiana, western Arkansas, and the Ohio River Valley. Archaeological remains in these areas indicate that the Native Americans evaporated the brine in shallow clay salt pans, most likely by adding hot rocks to the brackish water. They also retrieved salt from ashes of certain plants and from salt-impregnated sand. They sometimes gathered rock salt. Well-defined salt trails allowed the transport of salt to the east. Coastal Native Americans generally got their salt through trade rather than the evaporation of seawater, as wood for fire making is sparse near ocean beaches, and the moist sea air is unconducive to evaporation. The salt traders did not belong to any tribal group but traveled alone from tribe to tribe carrying baskets of salt gathered from salt lakes, along with other goods. As Native American cultural life crumbled in the face of the European invasion, the salt trade would have been an early victim of this disruption. Salt is critical for protection against parasites. We need the chloride in salt to make hydrochloric acid. Without salt, the stomach will not be sufficiently acidic to kill parasites. The point is that the so-called infectious diseases that caused so much suffering did not arrive until after a period of disruption and nutritional decline, and fear and despair almost certainly played a role. When disease broke out in a village, the afflicted often found themselves abandoned by those still healthy, so they had no one to care for them. Unable to get water for themselves, they typically died of thirst. This may explain why the death rates during outbreaks were so much higher for the Native Americans, typically 90%, than for Europeans, typically 30%. One disease blamed for Native American death was measles, considered to be a viral disease. But on February 16, 2016, the Federal Supreme Court of Germany, BGH, made a historic ruling: there is no evidence for the existence of a measles virus. The case grew out of a challenge by German biologist Stefan Lonka, who offered a sum of 100,000 euros to anyone who could supply proof that the measles virus existed. A young doctor, David Bardens, took up the challenge, providing Lonka with 6 studies as proof that the measles virus did indeed exist. When Lonka claimed that these studies did not meet the evidence needed to claim the prize, Bardens took him to court. The court sided with Bardens and ordered payment of the prize. But Lonka took the cases to the Supreme Court, where the judge decided in his favor and ordered the plaintiff to bear all the procedural costs. Lonka was able to show that the 6 studies misinterpreted ordinary constituents of cells as part of the suspected measles virus. According to Lonka, decades of consensus-building processes have created a model of a measles virus that doesn't actually exist. To this day, an actual structure that corresponds to this model has been found neither in a human nor in an animal. With the results of the genetic tests, all thesis of existence of measles virus has been scientifically disproved. The existence of a contagious measles virus justified the development of the measles vaccine, which has earned the pharmaceutical industry billions of dollars over a 40-year period. But if such a microorganism does not exist, said Lonka, this raises the question of what was actually injected into millions of German citizens over the past decades. According to the judgment by the Supreme Court, it may not have been a vaccine against measles. But what about measles parties? What about successful attempts by parents to infect their children with the common childhood diseases like measles, chicken pox, and mumps? And what about sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis, said to be a disease that the Europeans contracted from the Native Americans? The mystery of childhood illnesses and sexually transmitted diseases will be addressed in Chapter 7.